Okay, so the recording device is on. Where is my names book? Here it is.
There is a book.
Okay. So I'm going to put Scott's name here. Can I borrow your pen a minute, Coralie? Scott.
Does it write?
Yep. Ronan, Scott, Song, Rima, Coralie.
Thank you.
Ray.
What's the date today?
Six. Adelaide, Patricia, Yvette. Okay, first things first. Now, does anybody not have a copy of Remembering Babylon yet? Everybody's got a copy. Have you got a copy, Scott? You've got a copy. Now, I handed out 2 weeks ago, I handed out copies of Remembering Babylon, and some of the copies had covers that were different to this. And the copies that are different covers to this have different page numbers in them. So I'd like everybody to have a copy, this copy. So who has got the older copy? Okay, take this. Take this and give the other one back to me, all right?
Okay.
Give the other one back to me when you next week or today if you've got it. You don't have one at all? Okay,
there it is. No, I do have one, but I don't remember if it's safe.
Okay,
take this and bring it back.
Have you got one, Ray? Yes.
Yeah, I've got one original.
You got one, Ronan?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, good. So everybody's got one.
So we're going to do some reading of learning parts tonight, just so that everyone knows. Find the 10 people and we'll talk to some of that.
We're starting Remembering Babylon next week. Okay, next week we're starting it. We're going to have 2 weeks on Remembering Babylon.
So we need to have it read by then?
You have to at least have got about halfway into it. Okay, halfway into it by next week, and then the other half by the following week. And then there's a week off, and in that week off we're going to the art gallery so we can relax a bit, and you've got another week to finish reading it. And then we've got David Malouf coming, who's going to be here, and it would be certainly good if you've all read the novel by then and have questions for him, have a good discussion with him. It'd be great.
Which art gallery?
The New South Wales Art Gallery in Art Gallery Road behind the Domain.
Is that on 3 o'clock on Wednesday, is it?
We haven't decided and worked that out yet because it's actually in the stand down week, and we'll try and have it, of course, when everybody can be there. It might be earlier in the day. Mm-hmm. All right, might be 1 o'clock even. We'll see.
I think Wednesday nights now.
So we'll still have learning parts.
It's open Wednesday.
No, Wednesday nights it's open late.
It's late. They have lecturers and they have people
they do.
Talk about their art.
They do, that's right.
Happens on Wednesday.
And you can go there late. You can go there late.
Go there often.
Yeah.
You go there often.
Yes.
Fantastic.
It's a lovely night, and you can watch three movies.
That's right.
I don't go there. I've been there once in a long time. And that was only going listen to Ando about his painting.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
Of Jack and why he incorporated insects into the painting.
That's right, I saw those.
Yeah, especially moths and crickets.
That's right, they're right. That's right.
Eyebrows and
I know, I saw that.
It's pretty crazy.
It is. So, what I've done, I've given you questions, the essay questions to choose from. I'm just going to read them through now and just give you a little tiny bit of a head up on them so that it might help you and guide you in your reading of the novel. The first question, you choose one of the following topics, and this is not for your blogs, this is for your essay, all right? The first question, Jemmy Fairley seems to have a positive effect on some of the characters in the novel. These include Jock McIver and his daughter Janet. Choose one of these characters, Jock or Janet, and describe the effect that Jemmy's presence has on them. Now, in the novel, you will discover that Jemmy Fairley has been brought up in an Aboriginal family somewhere out west of Queensland. And he's not Aboriginal himself. He's from England, but he was...
He fell overboard
and scrambled to shore and was taken up by an Aboriginal family. So he's become...
He's a spirit.
Yeah. And this is actually based on a true story. This is something we talk to David Malouf about.
So it was a true story.
Based on a true story. And after a certain time, I think when Jemmy Fairley's in his early teens, his birth...
26.
26.
And he was 13.
16 in the book.
Yeah.
Oh, 16?
Yeah.
So he decides to leave the Aboriginal community because he wants to go back to his own people.
He wants to find his language.
He wants to find his language.
And smells horseshit.
That's right.
Oh, I know that smell, and that's what made him go to the fence line, hang that's around right. the fence line, that's and right. study what was beyond it.
That's right.
And then he got the guts to go there.
That's right. So he's trying to find his roots again, trying to find his roots in his language. He's lost his language because he's been brought up by Aboriginals and he speaks their language, but he's trying to find a reconnection. He's trying to find his tongue. You tell me you don't know this book, you know it better than I do. He's found by a couple of kids. Janet is one of them, Janet McIver.
She's the eldest daughter.
She's the eldest daughter. And cousin... what's the cousin's
Lachlan?
Name? Lachlan. Lachlan. The cousin is Lachlan from Scotland.
It's actually he found kids, not kids found. Kids was playing.
But the kids were playing there and suddenly this thing appeared on a fence, standing up on the fence.
For what, war game?
That's right. So anyway, he's found by these kids, Janet being one of them, and Janet brings him home, and the father sees this person, this weird-looking person, and the father obviously feels some sympathy for this guy and takes him in at his home. That's where the story begins. Now, the problem is that this is a little township on the coast of Queensland, somewhere about halfway up Queensland.
It says in the book it's about half an hour outside of
Bowen. And David Maloof himself grew up in Queensland. Now, the story is sort of loosely based on fact, but little township near Bowen was a very tiny township, and the people there in general were kind of terrified of any outsiders, especially of Indigenous people. There was this terror that they were going to be murdered at night, and all the spears were going to come flying over the fences and what have you. So the reaction and the response to Jemmy Fairley from most of the community is one of hatred and wanting to get rid of him. It's a typical kind of scenario of people wanting to expel the outsider.
Mm.
But David Maloof's novel's got a twist to it, because this outsider, Jemmy Fairley, has got some special qualities. He's obviously found something through his connection with Indigenous people. He's got some spiritual depth. He's got something that the people in the community, the other people, don't have. And this something is communicated to the girl Janet, who's found him, and to her father, to Jock. And a change takes place in them. And the book is about the kind of changes that take place in these people who've opened their heart to the outsider. But the community as a whole want to reject him, and they do terrible things. They try and drown him one night. They pull him out of his bed in Jock McIver's house, put him in a sack, and take him down to the river and try and drown him. And the other people say, let's pot him, let's kill him, let's get rid of him. Eventually, well, look, I'm not going to spoil this plot for you now.
I'm not going to spoil the plot. He finds his tongue.
He does find his tongue.
And then he turns around and tells them all where he came from.
Well, I'm not going to talk anymore.
Yeah,
you want to come here and tell the story, you can. No. I don't want to spoil the story for you. But anyway, that's the basis of it. And the basis then... choose one of these characters and describe the effect that Jemmy's presence has on them, because that's important.
Choose one of them.
Yeah, don't worry, I'll get it printed out for you. Question two, excluding the McIvers, that's Janet and Jock and his wife, describe how Jemmy Fairley as an outsider is received by the rest of the local community. What is David Maloof's attitude to the way Jemmy is received? One of the reasons I'm bringing David Maloof here is because David Maloof is very sympathetic both to this course and to the situation that you guys find yourselves in. He's very sympathetic to people who are outside the established status quo. And this book is about that. This book is about the way somebody who's been alienated through circumstances beyond his own control is suddenly hated by the rest of the community. But David Maloof is showing that the outsider is such an important part of a potential community and really has got something to offer. So David Maloof kind of breathes a real sort of humanity into a society which always wants to exclude people who are slightly different from the norm. That's what David Maloof's agenda is. So he really likes coming here and likes to discuss his work with you. So the second question is about how do people treat the outsider, and there's quite a bit in the book about that, even early on in the early chapters, you know, how we're terrified of anything that's slightly different from the norm. Third question it's starting with a quote, that quote that we've already talked about, but actually the quote's repeated on the last page of the novel. Jemmy, as she saw him, and this is Janet thinking, Janet, who at this stage of the novel, by the end of the novel, she's middle-aged. Jemmy, as she saw him once for all up there on the stripped and shiny rail, never to fall, and Flash, that's their dog, slicing the air with his yelps in clear dog language, and his arms flung out, never to, I think that should be lift, I've made a typo there, never to lift him clear, overbalancing now, drawn by the power, all unconscious in them of their gaze, their need to draw him into their lives, love, again love, overbalanced but not yet falling. That's the quote with one typo in it. The quote appears at the beginning of the novel and is repeated at the end. This passage is from the last page and a half of the book. Malouf is a poet and chooses here to finish his book through powerful poetic imagery. What is this imagery trying to tell the reader at the end of this story? And we're going to be talking about that imagery next week when we look at it in the beginning of the book, trying to work out what this picture of Jemmy standing on the fence, balanced, not falling this way, not falling that way, dog barking at him here, children looking up at him in amazement, what does that mean? And how does it kind of hold the whole story together? Okay, fantastic.
It's
on the website.
I will
print it out for you for next week. I'll print it out and bring it for you for next week as well. So there's a discussion and blog questions from last week, and this is this week. This week our focus is the African-American author Alice Walker and her story Everyday Use and Henry Lawson's comic story The Loaded Dog. And
she's an
amazing woman. And I'll be coming to that shortly. I've got another blog here for today, which is also about Alice Walker and Lawson, and there are some new blog questions there. All right? But before we go there, I want to look at your blogs, what's been happening. So let's have a little wander through your blogs. So, just a few comments about people's blogs. Let's go to Yvette. So, okay. Now put some comments on your blog site. Did you read them, Yvette? You didn't. So to read your comments, let me have a look. To read your comments, you need to go in and click on the comments button because they... Let's have a look. Yeah, your comments are not appearing automatically here, so after the session... After the session, go and have a look. You can approve them. I can't... it's interesting why I can't see them there. So anyway, here it is. What is the joy that kills? Let me make this a bit bigger. This is Yvette. Joy is an overwhelming... Should be an, by the way. Before a vowel... Before a A-E-I-O-U, A always becomes an. Okay? Joy is an overwhelming, intense, and quite passionate feeling. The emotion of joy when the disappointment of receiving heartbreaking news of someone has been rescued, such as the news of the loss of a loved one, can be too much to bear. This can be so intense that there can be a lack of self-control of emotion that may be disastrous in giving someone a heart attack. It can be overwhelming. There was a moment that she felt relieved that he was gone and could move on with her life. That moment was brief. She felt both sadness and joy that there was another chapter in her life. The reality that you can't move on, can't has got an apostrophe between the N and the T. I think I put this into the comments. The reality that you can't move on can be frustrating and can lead to anxiety. In conclusion, I believe sometimes we need self-control of our emotions, which can have devastating consequences and can even be deadly. For example, sometimes we need anger management techniques to deal with our emotions. A comma should be there after deadly, before for example. But that's very well written. Yvette's a good writer. She's really clear and precise in her writing. And the blog is not too long. It says it answers the question very clearly. Describe how you understand this key idea. So really good, Yvette. I will suggest to people in a couple of weeks' time you can start adding images and illustrations to your blog by copying down from Google. Just go there and copy it from the URL. My students at uni like to jazz their sites up with all sorts of images.
Not easy.
I'll show you. It's dead easy. Dead easy if you know how. So thank you, Yvette, for that. It's really good. So let's go to song. Questions on the story of an hour. This is the one here. And also, I've put some comments on your blog, so you have to go and approve the comment and read the comment there. You think you did? That's interesting why it's not appearing here. Let me have a look.
I clicked on the...
Yep.
Yeah.
What is the joy that kills? Okay. So you had some good ideas also here. Describe how you understand this key idea in the story. When the storm of grief had spent itself, she went away to her room alone. This line tells me that her turning point comes quickly. Her grief turns to joy. She sees her independence returning back to her as she will be free from the burden of marriage. Well, nicely structured sentence. You worked with your learning partner on that. Yes. You got a good idea. They helped you really form that beautifully.
Yes.
A kind intention or cruel intention made the act seem no less a crime as she looked upon it in that brief moment of illumination. And then your comment, the illumination that she mentions now lights up the picture, what she wants to see in the scenery. Something a little bit odd there. I think I corrected this in your comment. Now lights up the picture of what she wants to see. You need of in there, in the scenery. Every single matter became delightful, not become delightful, becomes delightful. That verb needs an S on the end of it. I think I also put that in your... When I make comments in your blog, you can go in and edit your blog again and change and make the corrections that I've asked you to make, so that then your blog to the outside world is a perfect piece of writing. That's the purpose of me doing the edit, so you learn what needs to be corrected. But all of a sudden she sees her husband alive, which means that she has to grieve again for the loss of her autonomy. Beautiful, very nice, very well put. Now she can either remain in the newfound joy or go back to her role as a wife, such that she might remain alive but kill her freedom. She probably chooses to maintain her joy subconsciously and this kills her. Well understood. Lovely. And then Rima. Rima's done it amazingly long. Amazing. Okay, it's the first blog post. This is about Tim Winton's sand. Yeah, this is lovely. I'm not going to read all of this, Rima. It's a PhD thesis, but it's well written, and you've followed my advice. You've used shorter sentences, and you've written it well. Did you work with your learning partner on this? You didn't. It was just your own work, is it? So I think it's good to get your learning partner to read through it with you and tighten it up a little bit. So let's just read the first paragraph. The main characters of Tim Winton's Sand, the two brothers, Max and Frank. Oh, I've got a comment on here. Look, now this is interesting. Some of the blogs show the comment, and there's my comment, but others, you can't find the comment immediately. So you must have clicked approve the comment.
Yeah.
Did you click anything there? Do you remember?
No, I didn't open it.
You didn't open it. Oh, my God. Okay. Mysterious. Rima, you take us beautifully inside the hidden drama of this story by focusing attention on the way the descriptive imagery suggests a number of things that are not spoken about on the surface. You really help to open up the secret side of this story. Well done, and thank you. Let's just read a little bit of it. The main characters of Tim Winton's Sand, the two brothers, Max and Frank, seem to be diametrically opposite to each other in personality. Frank, the younger brother, is as gentle, caring and loving a soul as his elder brother, Max, appears to be callous, insensitive, tough and a bully, especially towards Frank. I'd put a full stop in the middle of that paragraph before Max, so two separate sentences, because the two sentences are running into each other there and competing with each other. In the opening of the story, Frank is depicted as delicately attuned to the minute details of objects and people who are of special interest to him. Overall, the possible sounds that he could have heard coming from the ocean, or the whispers and chattering of the wind, or the squawking of seabirds. For example, he hears the soft clink of the lantern glass. Concentrating on its rhythmic beat, he falls in step with it and begins singing under his breath. Is the author trying to present insight into the boy's striving to reach some kind of personal harmony lacking in his life? Very good. Very nice little observation there. Yeah, about you know, we were talking about the clinking and the sounds and what they meant, and you've kind of homed in there to hear that. Frank misses his mother, who for some unspecified reason has disappeared for the last 2 weeks. Since Frank is not allowed to talk about her, he does what he can. In his imagination, he summons his mother along with her friends to join the party with his father and friends. His father is back for another summer. Since Frank is getting used to him in his seasonal return, the boy wraps his unconditional love around his father again, and covering him entirely in his affectionate attention, Frank notices every detail about him. From the squint of his eyes, to the cracks of his palms, to the veins of his legs that stand out as he walks just a few steps ahead of Frank, to the child's unbounded joy along the beach. So what you're doing here, which is really good, you're observing very closely the details in the story, and you're explaining and understanding what these details are showing the reader. And that's, you know, that's part of what literary criticism and writing about literature is. So you're doing very well. Frank remembers his mother a little later, futilely wishing for her presence and support when he's once again targeted for Max's brutality. Excellent. So, you know, I recommend there's more. It's only halfway through. I recommend go and... You've got all each other's blog addresses. Go and read each other's blogs and make a comment on each other as well. That would be really helpful to each other, and it's good for you to read what other people are doing. So, Adelaide,
how
I think...
How do we know what other people's... Where we find other people's addresses?
They're all in Leo. They're all listed there.
In Leo, you go and then you press on it, but then you go to look at that. You can't until they approve you. You got to get everybody to approve you before you can read their shit. I mean, read their work, sorry.
You got to get them to approve you.
Yes.
That's what you found.
Yeah.
Okay.
If they haven't approved you, you can't read their stuff.
Okay. Okay. I thought it was automatic if you were... If you were a WordPress blogger yourself, that you were could have access to the other blogs.
Yeah, no, I've tried looking at...
You've tried.
Purples and I've...
And have you been able to get in yet?
I look at the songs and...
Okay, so please, when you get a request for someone to read your blog from the group, click yes, approve, so that they can read your blog, all right? That's important. Now, this is Adelaide.
But it's a week late.
It's a week...
Sort of thing.
Hang on a second. I made a comment on this. There's a comment. This is a wonderfully vivid description that sounds like it could be the beginning of an interesting semi-erotic story. I love the expansive graphic imagery which links the poor gentleman's physical condition with his lack of hunting. Why don't you continue, Adelaide? Did you read that comment, by the way?
Yeah, I did.
You read it. Okay. Yeah. Well, here's the beginning of Adelaide's...
I was nearly going to take this off because I thought it was crap.
Well, let's see what other people think.
Oh, I think it's crap.
His genitalia was not firm and taut, but hanging low and sheathed in satin. He had the air of a ravaged nobleman who had led a life of debauchery. A lack of hunting with the hounds had added to his pale skin that glistened. No ruddy complexion, almost all health drained away, except the infantile appeal in his eyes. He needed a small token of pleasure, and I was in the present giving mood. There you go. Adelaide, you're on a roll. Finish it off for us. But I noticed there you've got one short sentence and the rest is all one long sentence. I tend to break it down into smaller units. But yeah, that's interesting, interesting material. Interesting material.
It's so funny because at the beginning of the course you said, what can we write? Are we allowed to write like this stuff?
That's right.
And she's gained the courage and written that book.
She's got into it, that's right. Next we've got Ronan. Now where's Ronan up to this time? Oh, you did a review of the story. Did I comment? I commented on everything. I think I commented here. Okay. This is a precise insight into the psychology of what is going on in the story, Ronan, and I love your sense of how the structure of the story follows the emotional curve of the character's experience. Your second paragraph needs some work on the sentence structure to make your ideas clearer. It'd be worthwhile going over with the learning partners. If I make a comment like that, it's good to get your blogs looking really good up online so that when you go for a job or talk to anybody else, they go and read your blogs and they see somebody who can write well. This is an advertisement for your own capacities as well as everything else.
Yeah, I think I just had too many commas in there.
Perhaps, yep. I'm going to suggest three short sentences like this to your second paragraph, and there I've rewritten the paragraph for you and I've asked you, do you think that makes it clearer what you're saying? So if you do think that, then go in and make the changes in the blog itself. But here is here's Ronan's very precise observations. The story of an hour varies from your conventional story. Now, interest, just a matter of convention here, when it comes to your essay, when you refer to a story or a poem or a novel, you have to show the reader that the story or the poem or the novel is something different from your main text. So when you're doing the story of an hour, the story of an hour is blah blah blah, a story and a poem, you put double inverted commas around it. That's what you do. With a novel, like Remembering Babylon, it's italics. So novels, longer works, even paintings, which are big works, films, italics. And shorter works, like poems, like mangoes, for example, mangoes in inverted commas, like that. This is just the convention for when you're doing professional writing, that uni, whenever you're referring to a book or to a poem or an essay, inverted commas or... Are you okay, Ray?
Yeah.
Are you in another world or are you still with us?
Yeah.
Good, okay. You're dreaming.
Yeah.
Very good. I hope it was a good dream.
Yeah. You're dreaming about what Adelaide wrote.
That's, yeah. Ah, that's what it was.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
here we go. The story of an hour varies from your conventional story in style with the smooth flow and twisted ending. The emotional structure and flow moves in and out of happiness and to and fro from sadness, as does the story. I like the way you've understood the emotional structure and flow, Ronan. You kind of, you felt there's this, the structure changes, it moves from inside the character's experience to looking outside, and you've understood something about the way the language is capturing the quite complex experience that's being described. It is almost like she's drifting in and out of reality or losing control of her sanity, battling for self-gratification and identity. Lovely. And then the second paragraph, the one that I've corrected down here, we've corrected it down here. To me, the joy that kills represents her state of fragile mortality. The headspace Mrs. Mallard was in was illogical and unpredictable. Apparent was her inability to deal with the polarity of her emotional mood swings. Beautiful. And all I've done is divided it up into three sentences and put two full stops in there. That's a good exposition of the story. So we've come to Ray. Now, Ray, I don't think you did anything this week.
He did do it. Couldn't get it to load.
Okay, yeah, but it's not there. It's not visible.
Not visible.
It wasn't last night. Is it there now or not?
I did it last week.
It's not there.
I've done it last night.
Okay, we'll have to help. I have to help you get it up after the session.
Yeah.
Get it done tonight. Yeah. And then we've got Josh.
I didn't put anything up.
You didn't. That's right. You didn't put anything on. I remember now. Yep. And we've got Neil.
I will put it up tonight, though.
Lovely. Now Neil's got a wonderful piece here. I thought it was fantastic, and I've got a comment here. No, where's the comment? Let's have a look at the comment first. Look at the comment first or the story first?
You're the teacher.
I'm the teacher. I think the comment
this
first.
This is your house, mate.
It is. Neil, that is a beautiful piece of writing that captures the intense but eventually resolved emotions of the girls and their father. And what you told us the class last week made me think maybe this is about you and your daughters. Maybe. I don't know. But
yeah, well,
I had the sense that...
It is self-reflective.
Yeah. I love especially the way you show the differences in the way the two girls respond to their dad. This writing has real life. These characters have emotions that pull the reader into the story. Well done. Here are a few changes or edits that you could make if you go into edit mode. That's what I want you to do. Do you know how to get into edit mode?
It's done already.
Done already! Wow! Fantastic! Let's go. I'm glad I read the comments first. Michelle and her younger sister Emily waited out on the front step. Today was to be the day that their father was to come and visit. The summer sun torched and tormented their skinny legs while they waited. "He's not coming, is he?" said Emily. "Oh, shut up," replied her older sister. "You always say that." Their father was in fact always late, or would simply just not show. Michelle knew that her father had issues that young girls shouldn't know about. The girl's mother had no problem stating the blooming obvious when it came to the girl's father's defects. He was involved with the wrong crowd and was a thief, also had problems with drugs. Whilst Emily continued waiting, watching her snow-white legs turn red like beetroot, she loved her dad and thought the sun shone from his ass. He could do no wrong in her eyes. Michelle paced back and forth in rhythm with her own shadow, trying and watching to make herself bigger, taller. It gave her the strength to hold back her tears. "What are you doing, Michelle? He's not coming, is he?" "Emily, if you knew what I knew about Dad, you would hate him. I won't tell you either, so don't ask, okay?" This provoked Emily and she let fly with all sorts of obscenities. "Fuck you, Michelle. You always make out that our dad's a monster." "When he is," snapped Michelle. The girls were at it now. "Bitch, cow, booger, eater." It was always like this when it came time for them to meet their dad. The girls were in the middle of a catfight when suddenly they heard his voice. "What in hell are you two fighting about?" It was him, the man they knew to be their father. His voice was not loud and harsh like both of them had envisioned. It was soft, calm, warm, like the sun that once was burning and tormenting them both. "Dad, you came, you really came." Michelle remained composed with her anger that lay within her. But Emily broke down sobbing. Tears filled her ocean blue eyes, intent on rolling down her red flustered cheek. Their father's arms wide open, his palms hard like the pavement underfoot. They all embraced in a huge cuddle. Michelle was hesitant, looking at the shadow that moments before she was embroiled with. Emily hugged him so hard, so very hard, as if this be the last hug she'd ever have with her father. Beautiful, beautiful.
No, I was trying to write in the same kind of style of Tim Winter.
Yeah, you did.
I don't know if I did or not.
You did, you got it, you got it. Yeah, it's lovely the way you've kind of paralleled the two young brothers with the two sisters here and the father in the situation. So, you know, you've really done something well. You say here, I've tried to portray a style of writing in this piece that I've written called Mist. Trying to understand the different styles of writing is a challenge. I hope that this piece has imitated the style of Tim Winter. Yeah, it's got your own style in it as well. It's really good. Want more? More, please. Fantastic. Well, that's your lot. I'm going home now. No, not really.
Yeah.
Not really. We're going to look now at something else, at Alice Walker to begin with. Now, she is an amazing author.
Indeed, so.
I've got blog topics down here, but I've also put them up onto my website. And everyday use. How many of you got a chance to read everyday use?
I've read it in here.
Yep.
But when I tried to find it on her site, it's in Spanish.
Yeah. Why did you try and find it on the site?
Well, because you said it's last week to click on their names and have a look at them. So I did.
Click on their names and have a look about them.
Yes.
About
them.
About the author. Did you get into a Spanish site?
No. She
writes in English.
She writes in English. Why does it get translated?
I don't know what's going on there. Maybe you clicked on the wrong side or...
No, it was definitely her.
Was it?
Yeah, and photos of her watching the eclipse and everything.
Oh, right.
I'm showing her own photo of a tree that's on a blog, and the tree's huge, and a little man like this big.
Yep.
And I go up the top of the tree, and there's a little man at the top of the tree. Like, the men are like... She's a great humanitarian. Yeah.
She is. She's amazing. Yeah. You learned about that. You're great. So this story is amazing. And the blogs I've given you to think about write a descriptive contrast of two very contrasting people in your own family, or explain what you think Dee or Mama value their heritage the most. why you think Dee and Mama value their heritage the most. This story is called Everyday Use. And Everyday Use, it's number...
It's after prose.
After prose. And it's number... I think I have the number. I did have the number on here. That's the page it starts there. That's what it looks like. That's the one.
You got it. Loaded dog, and then she's after.
She's after the loaded dog. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got it. You got it. It's Terry. There it is. You got it there. It goes from there and then across to here. There and then. It goes from here and then across.
Yeah.
We had to number it ourselves.
We did get you to do that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things going on in this story, and I've put a little list here of some of the things that we're going to look at. There's the structure of the story. Like when we talk about structure, structure of the story, structure. It could be chronological.
Meaning?
That it means, chronological means going from A to B.
Right.
You know, from morning to evening.
Yeah. Thank you for putting that in terms for us. It's
chronological.
In a kind of sequence. Time.
Or it could be fragmentary, so you know, shifting from one time to another. So there's many ways of talking about structure. The setting is where it takes place, and this takes place mainly in Ma's house and Mama's house and garden. And the story is about two sisters, Maggie and Dee. Characterization here. The characters' characterization are Maggie, her sister Dee. Now Maggie and Dee and their mother suffered the burning down of their house. The house burnt down. And Maggie was seriously injured. And she lost partially her sight, and she was disfigured partly. And so she's always been fearful and withdrawn.
Do you know how their house burnt down?
I don't know how their house burnt down.
How was that quiet? What's the premise?
Do you know that for a fact?
Yeah, it's on my site. That's why she's so into humanitarian stuff.
The elder sister, Dee, wasn't injured and has made a great success of her life. And the story is about Dee coming home to visit Mama and Maggie. And the drama takes place in that confrontation. And I'm not going to tell you the story because I'm going to read it to you. But as we go through it, I'm going to point out quite a few things which you might like to make notes of in the story as we go through it. This story first appeared in Love and Trouble Stories of Black Women in 1973, written for your grandmama. Now the first thing, when you hear this first paragraph, you'll ask yourself, who is the speaker? Who is the speaker? And that's something you have to work out. Who is the speaker?
It's not Tony Slipper.
It's not Tony Slipper. Let's listen to it. I will wait for her in the yard that Maggie and I made so clean and wavy yesterday afternoon. A yard like this is more comfortable than most people know. It's not just a yard. It's like an extended living room, when the hard clay is swept clean as a floor and the fine sand around the edges lined with tiny irregular grooves, anyone can come and sit and look up into the elm tree and wait for the breezes that never come inside the house. Who do you think's speaking?
The mother.
The mother.
What Isn't
do?
It?
Yeah, it is the mother. It's the mother, Maggie and I. Now, when someone's speaking, they're telling us something about their situation and where they are, but they're also indirectly telling us something about themselves. What is she telling us about herself implicitly? Or what is the author telling us implicitly through the way she's got Mama to speak here? What kind of a person is Mama?
Proud.
Proud, yep.
Lonely.
What was that, Neil?
Lonely.
Proud. Okay, Mama is proud. Lonely. What else?
Lonely, yes.
What else? What sort of characteristics does she have as a human being in terms of what she does and how she does it?
Strong and determined.
Conscientious.
Strong, determined, conscientious. Good.
Sensible.
Yeah. Good. All those things you see, all those things come out. Now this is sort of what Rima was doing when she was looking at the Tim Winton story. She was kind of drawing out all these elements from what you hear. It's not just telling us facts, it's kind of telling us all about the character that's being described. Let's read the next paragraph. Maggie will be nervous until after her sister goes. She will stand hopelessly in corners, homely and ashamed of the burn scars down her arms and legs, eyeing her sister with a mixture of envy and awe. She thinks her sister has held life always in the palm of one hand, that no is a word the world never learnt to say to her. Okay, now, I've got two daughters in a very similar situation, let me tell you. They both live in Newcastle, and one of them is highly successful, and the other one has got a lot of problems. So I relate to this story very much. It comes very close to home to me. But in this paragraph, what is the mother telling us about what she thinks about Maggie?
Jealous.
She's telling us she's jealous. What's the mother's attitude to Maggie?
Sympathetic.
Sympathetic. Yep. Mama's attitude to Maggie. What else? Sympathetic. Anything else comes up?
Realistic. Aware.
Sorry, what was that?
Realistic.
Realistic. Jack, did you say something?
Aware.
Okay. Yeah, aware. Aware of what's happening. All right, let's read on. It's a long story. You better keep moving, otherwise we won't get to the end of it. Something happens in this next paragraph that's related to structure. Are we going? Is the story moving chronological here? Have a listen and you tell me what's happening. You've no doubt seen those TV shows where the child who has made it is confronted as a surprise by her own mother and father, tottering in weakly from backstage. A pleasant surprise, of course. What would they do if parent and child came on the show only to curse out and insult each other? On TV, mother and child embrace and smile into each other's faces. Sometimes the mother and father weep. The child wraps them in her arms and leans across the table to tell how she would not have made it without their help. I've seen these programs. Sometimes I dream a dream in which Dee, the other sister, in which Dee and I are suddenly brought together on a TV program of this sort. Out of a dark and soft-seated limousine, I am ushered into a bright room filled with many people. There I meet a smiling, grey, sporty man like Johnny Carson who shakes my hand and tells me what a fine girl I have. Then we are on the stage and Dee is embracing me with tears in her eyes. She pins on my dress a large orchid, even though she has told me once that she thinks orchids are tacky flowers. In real life, I am a large, big-boned woman with rough, man-working hands. In the winter, I wear flannel nightgowns to bed and overalls during the day. We all on the right page?
It just goes straight to the
next top page, that's right. Overalls during the day. I can kill and clean a hog as mercilessly as a man. My fat keeps me hot in zero weather. I can work outside all day, breaking ice to get water for washing. I can eat pork liver cooked over the open fire minutes after it comes steaming from the hog. One winter I knocked a bull calf straight in the brain between the eyes with a sledgehammer and had the meat hung up to chill before nightfall. But of course, all this does not show on television. I am the way my daughter would want me to be, 100 pounds lighter, my skin like an uncooked barley pancake. My hair glistens in the hot bright lights. Johnny Carson has much to do to keep up with my quick and witty tongue. But that is a mistake. I know even before I wake up. Whoever knew a Johnson with a quick tongue? Who can even imagine me looking a strange white man in the eye? It seems to me I've talked to them always with one foot raised in flight, with my head turned in whichever way is farthest from them. Dee, though. She would always look anyone in the eye. Hesitation was no part of her nature. All right, that's a long section. That's a subsection of the story. First of all, chronology. Chronology. Yes, Scott.
It's part of the same
one. Yep. No, it's the same one. Same story. Part of the same story. But I'm glad you asked that question, because your question illustrates what's happening here. It doesn't seem like it's part of the same story. It seems like it's a broken continuity. It's as if the mother, as the narrator, has stepped out of telling the story and is now looking at it from another angle, imagining one of these reality TV shows where the daughter who's really made it is brought onto the TV set and embraces the parent that she hasn't seen for a while, tells the parent how important she's been in her life.
This is your life.
This is your life, exactly. That's the Australian version of it. So what's the mother telling us? What's the mother telling us about this imagined dream she's having about a TV show in which she appears with her good daughter? What's the mother think about this?
I think she's... Her daughter is trying to... Would like her to be, you know, a lot more... less butchier than what she is.
That's true. The daughter, Dee, who's made it...
I don't mean that in any miscontext.
No, that's right. That's right. So we're getting a picture here of the mother, who's very down to earth and very butchy and, you know, works like a man in the farm, etc., and this daughter who's kind of entered a different scenario altogether as a well-dressed woman of sorts. Tension between these is really being expressed through this.
I think the daughter might be a bit ashamed of the mother.
Yeah, that's right. So you're getting through this non-chronological bit of writing here. Let me get a different colour up here.
It's gone into the future, hasn't it? It's not even talking about a real event.
It's imagining
so
something.
It's second guessing
that. Yeah. So.
I meant it's gone into a thought about the
story
future.
Moves into a futuristic fantasy.
Yeah.
It's almost written like a movie script almost.
It is. But it sets the scene for what happens, because Dee is now going to come home. And that's what the whole story is about. I'm going to read another paragraph and then we're going to stop for afternoon tea. But before I move on, the last little bit I read, you see in the second last line, there's a sentence that has Dee though. See that sentence? Dee though.
She could look anyone in the eye. She would always
look anyone. Oh, yeah, then D, though.
D, though, yes.
Now,
you know, it's interesting how authors kind of play with sentence structures to make a point that's not made explicitly, but you can hear it in the tone of voice.
No.
It seems to me I've talked to them always with one foot raised in flight, with my head turned in whatever way is furthest from them. So the mother is saying that she wouldn't have anything to do with white interviewees. She wouldn't have anything to do with this kind of program with Johnny Carson.
She's fearful of white.
Yeah. Dee, though.
Yeah.
You know, that's a different kettle of fish. And that's what this whole story is about. The mother, who feels her blackness, feels her traditional quality, has this semi-invalided daughter, Maggie, at home, And he's now having to face and confront this wealthy daughter that's made it, coming home to visit them. And this, the whole story goes around this, and it's quite amazing what happens. Okay, let's read on a little bit, just to whet your appetite. "How do I look, Mama?" Maggie says, showing just enough of her thin body, enveloped in pink skirt and red blouse, for me to know she's there, almost hidden behind the door. "Come out into the yard," I say. Mother talking. "Have you ever seen a lame animal, perhaps a dog, run over by some careless person rich enough to own a car, sidle up to someone who is ignorant enough to be kind to him? That is the way my Maggie walks. She's been like this, chin on chest, eyes on ground, feet in shuffle, ever since the fire that burnt the other house to the ground." What's Mum think about Maggie's? What does Mum think about Maggie?
Obviously, as a mother, she'd be upset, but she's just describing the brutality of the way a daughter is, like her daughter appears.
That's
like,
right. The brutality of what she's experienced, yes. Wishing her daughter be different,
yes.
Wishing that the daughter wasn't so kind of hanging back and wishing she'd come out, yes. But not knowing what to do as a mother. That's it. Next paragraph about Dee.
She's very critical, I think.
You think she is critical? Well, that's interesting. The way the story develops, we get a sense more and more of the depth of Mama's attitude to Maggie. It might seem critical at the moment.
Very protective.
Protective, yeah, good.
No, it might seem harsh, but you know how you have to be cool to be kind in a sort of a...
Yeah.
But she didn't say those things to Maggie.
She didn't.
No, she didn't.
That's Maggie. Right. That's how she looked.
That's and right.
She described what she was wearing.
That's right.
Described her thin body, but then went on to her own thoughts.
Yep, yep.
And said, if you were to see her,
yep,
this
yep.
is what you would see.
That's right. So that's really good you've picked that up. The story, you see, is not just telling a linear story about three people meeting each other and interacting. The story's got a lot of Mama, who is the narrator, filling in all the background of her attitudes and feelings about the events. That's the way this works. The next paragraph is actually about Dee. Dee, and Dee hasn't arrived home yet, by the way. Dee is lighter than Maggie, with nice hair and a fuller figure. She's a woman now, though sometimes I forget. How long ago was it that the other house burned? 10, 12 years? Sometimes I can still hear the flames and feel Maggie's arms sticking to me, her hair smoking and her dress falling off her in little black papery flakes. Her eyes seem stretched open, blazed open by the flames reflected in them. And Dee? I see her standing off under the sweet gum tree she used to dig gum out of, a look of concentration on her face as she watched the last dingy grey board of the house fall in towards the red-hot brick chimney. Why don't you do a dance around the ashes? I'd wanted to ask her. She had hated the house that much. Something of Mama's attitude to Dee coming out at that point? What do you think, Yvette? Why don't you do a dance around the ashes, I'd wanted to ask her. She hated that house that much. What's Mama's attitude towards Dee, who's standing off in the distance under the gum tree, while Mama's cradling Maggie, who's been seriously burnt?
She's an ungrateful bitch. She's into self-preservation,
self-centered,
not caring.
That's it. I think there is that element there. The sense of being self-centered and not caring, that's right. She was lucky that she didn't get burnt, but...
She wasn't helping.
She wasn't helping. She wasn't involved. And she hated...
Like me, I'm very, very self-centered.
You're right.
And there's another side of me that can be very caring.
Well, that's right. There's always many sides to a person. Let's look at the next paragraph and then we'll have a break. I used to think she hated Maggie too. But that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her, Dee, to Augusta to school. She used to read to us without pity, forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us two, sitting trapped and ignorant underneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burnt us with a lot of knowledge we didn't necessarily need to know, pressed us to her with the serious way she read, to shove us away at just the moment, like dimwits we seemed about to understand. What's happened to Dee? And Dee's obviously been sent off because she's had money, the church and her, to send Dee off for an education. What's that education led to?
Well, Well, Dee was light enough to go to a school in the first place. She's lighter than Maggie. She says she's lighter in skin colour than Maggie.
Yep.
So therefore, she's able to go to school and get an education where the other two don't. They don't know how to read. They don't know how to write. But when Dee comes home, she throws it in their face all the time.
That's
as
right.
As if they're half-wits.
That's right. Now, I just want you to notice one important thing here. On the screen in front of you, the second dot point is themes. Now, when we're reading a story, when we're reading any story, you come up against ideas. Ideas and themes, they're sort of synonymous words. Themes or ideas. A story doesn't only tell events, it introduces ideas. Now, we've just struck a really important idea here. What's the idea we've struck?
Culture.
Sorry?
Culture.
Culture. Yeah, that's. I didn't have that word in mind, but that's along the tracks I was thinking. What about culture, Colin? What is it about culture? Sorry?
The sense of culture, or like sense of self.
Who?
The mothers, the child, both children.
Oh, there's a number of things there, aren't there? There's
the way the mother is towards her imagery towards white folk.
Mother's sense of self.
Yes, and the mother's
her culture.
Misery for his burnt daughter.
Situation.
What about D? What's this paragraph telling us about D?
She tries to impose her.
Why does she try to impose it? What has led her to want to impose her values?
She thinks she's better than.
Yeah, what's led to that?
The education.
That's it. So.
Education.
Value of education.
Value of knowledge.
Value of knowledge and education. And you'll see at the end of the story that this is a really major theme in this story, the value of education and knowledge. Dee sent to university, she's sent to a college. How does this help her relate to her family? And you're going to see at the end of the story a big argument about ownership of something that relates.
Sort of pulling them apart.
It's pulling them apart. So just read the next little paragraph at the top of the page, and then I promise you can go and have coffee and cheesecake. Is that right?
Is that cheesecake?
I don't know. Somebody told me it was cheesecake. Could be. Okay, top of the page. Dee wanted nice things. A yellow organdy dress. Organdy, I looked up, is a kind of very fine cotton. A yellow organdy dress to wear to her graduation from high school. Black pumps to match a green suit she'd made from an old suit somebody gave me. She was determined to stare down any disaster in her efforts. Her eyelids would not flicker for minutes at a time. Often I fought off the temptation to shake her. At 16, she had a style of her own and knew what style was. Now, does the mother like this or not? It's an interesting question, isn't it?
No, she's a bit jealous of it.
You think mama's jealous of it?
A bit envious.
She's acting improper for the way a lady should act. She's like...
A black lady, perhaps.
A black lady should act, yeah. She's like acting like a white girl.
But I still think there's envy there, you know, that it...
So another theme here, another theme, putting all those themes together, it's the theme I've got on the screen there anyway, is family relations and the tensions that come through that. I mean, one line that sort of spoke to me very clearly was, her eyelids would not flicker for minutes at a time. It's a very close observation. You know, some people, they stare you out, you know, don't you try and get me to do anything.
You think they've done this for a family, but
what?
You think they're doing all this for a family, and they're just misinterpreting it? Deep? They could be misinterpreting what she's doing. She could be doing all of this for them.
Well, this is
going
interesting. This is interesting.
Getting the power of education.
This
so that their house won't get burnt down by Ku Klux Klan, and they won't have to have prejudice being black.
That's all valid questions. That's what makes this story so interesting is whether the speaker, the point of view of the mama, is correct or not, because this is really interesting and you've raised a whole can of worms here.
Sorry.
A story has got a point of view. And point of view means From whose point of view? From whose? So this story is being told from Mama's point of view. You could tell this whole story from Dee's point of view. And you get a completely different story.
That's right, but you can't tell it from Maggie's point of view because Maggie's always talked as a second object.
That's right. But you could write a story from Maggie's point of view. And let me tell you that some authors, like David Malouf and others, have done this. They've written stories about three people from three different points of view. It's amazing what comes out from that.
Quentin Tarantino is one of the best writers when it comes to that kind of stuff.
You're right. Okay.
He makes movies like that.
Fantastic. Okay, let's go and have coffee. If that's what you want. I don't think there is cheesecake there, Scott. I hate to disappoint you.
I wouldn't eat it anyway.
You don't eat cheesecake. I'm glad to hear it.
Maybe I should bring in the cheesecake next week.
Maybe you should.
Yes. Yeah. We had mud cake yesterday.
So I might need two cheesecakes.
Do you make cheesecakes?
Yes, they're easy to make.
Yeah, they are.
Yes, Josh.
They're a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed, but I'm a little bit exhausted at the moment.
Okay. Did you not get a good sleep last night?
I had a good sleep. Because I've been 7 months on the medication,
yep.
I'm starting to feel the side effects more,
yep.
more and more. And even though I love this class,
yep.
it's a good class, at the moment I don't really concentrate on what's going on
right.
at the moment.
Right. So what do you want to do? You mean so, you can either just turn this off.